Three, two, one. Let's get started. Coming to you from Jackson, Mississippi, where I'm conducting training for the Jackson, Mississippi Police Department.
Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
So, what do you think about this? A person calls the police to ask them to check on a friend who he believes is sick. Emergency personnel arrive and the person's in bed with a gun, says he's going to fire a warning shot. The SWAT team with the negotiators called. One of the SWAT members says he'll fire a beanbag if the guy moves. The person extends his arm after saying he's going to fire a warning shot. And one SWAT member fires a beanbag, but as soon as that happens, the other SWAT member fires three rounds at the person's head and killing him. Is this excessive use of force? Well, that's what we're going to talk about today. Today is Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar's case is going to involve the use of deadly force, a use of force case and deadly force. I've had a number of cases come out. This one is, I love the use the recent cases. It's always fun to watch some folks from some of the other folks that put out information via email on cases to see them come out with one 2 months after I've already done a webinar on it. So I'd like to keep it fresh. In this case is Sanzone versus Gray. Came out of the Seventh Circuit. It's not even a week old. The date of the release was March 8th, 2018. Welcome to this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar for this this case of the week. The key phrases for this case is the key phrases are use of force, deadly force, and qualified immunity. This is a qualified immunity case. As you know, many of our use of force cases come to us in appellate decisions from civil court, not criminal criminal motions on these Fourth Amendment issues of use of force. And more often than not, it's a qualified immunity case where we're looking at these Fourth Amendment decisions regarding excessive use of force. Key cases for any use of force, you know without me even saying it, or you should, that Graham versus Connor is the gold standard for use of force cases. For deadly use of force in particular, we have Tennessee versus Garner, which came out 4 years before Graham versus Connor. Then Tennessee versus Garner kind of set the way for Graham versus Connor to originally or to come down with the adoption of the Fourth Amendment reasonableness standard for use of force as opposed to a Fifth or 14th Amendment due process standard, which made it much more difficult for plaintiffs to prevail. And then Saussure versus Katz, a Supreme Court decision from 2001. Those are our primary key cases, but these are very fact-driven. Most of you tuning into these webinars, either whether it's live, joining me live, which is always appreciated, or whether you're watching the video on the Vimeo channel or listening to the podcast on iTunes or Google Play, most of you are LEOs. Most of you very familiar with these cases. But with use of force, it's always good to look at fact. They're very fact-driven and see where it is the courts are holding that the force is reasonable and where it's not under these standards. It can be somewhat vague, and which is why we have the Graham factors. Let's take a look a little bit. I gave you a taste for the facts in the case. Let's dive just a little bit more in depth into the facts here, because it's going to be based on the facts, right? The very fact-driven decisions, the totality of the circumstances. So you have to have the totality in order to use the totality. This person calls, his name's Timothy Bess. He calls the police department in Indianapolis, Indiana. Now, he calls the police department. The facts in the case made it clear that it wasn't necessarily a 911 call. He calls the Metropolitan Police. He asked them to send someone over to check on his friend, who's named Keith Coster. He believes that Coster is ill. He's suffering from chronic fatigue, that he has some type of issue with his stomach, digestive system issues. He's throwing up and vomiting and having trouble breathing. And so they send over emergency personnel. They go over to respond to the call. They stop by the apartment complex manager, her name's Sarah Hunt, they stop by and they talk to her and they get a key to the apartment in case that he can't answer the door. So they want to be prepared to be able to go in case he doesn't answer the door. There's a gap in the facts. It's hard to tell at this point whether they actually knocked on the door before they went in. But in any case, it's clear that Officer Billy Murphy unlocks the door open the door. And from that point, the situation, as the court notes, escalated very quickly. Coster yelled not just once but repeatedly, "Don't come in." One of the firefighters that was there, one of the EMS firefighters that was there to provide medical assistance, said, "We're here to help you." But Coster shouts back, "If you enter my apartment, I will shoot you." So the EMS folks, the medical folks, warn the others about, they actually saw a gun in Coster's right hand, and then they leave. And so from the doorway, Officer Murphy takes control. He sees Coster sitting up in bed with a gun in his right hand, and he's swallowing pills. Murphy, he's talking with Coster, trying to convince him to put the gun down. And SWAT members show up, including Sergeant Walters and named defendant in this case, James Gray, Officer Gray. They arrive, and they change places with Officer Murphy. So Officer Murphy opens the door, starts communicating things escalate. He backs out of the way so these SWAT team members can go in. And they also go in with a hostage negotiator, Officer Daniel Rosenberg, and he starts talking to Coster. Coster wants to speak with a medical advocate. He also says he wants for them to contact his brother, who's an Indianapolis police officer. But he refuses to put the gun down, so he's still got the gun in his right hand. He seems to grow even more agitated, and then he declares he's going to fire a warning shot. And at this point, the SWAT officer Walters tells the other officers in front of him to stay down, because if Coster comes up, Walter is going to fire a beanbag round, a less lethal beanbag round at him. And he didn't want to hit any of the other officers that were in front of him, including Officer Gray. In front of him, he didn't want to hit any of the other officers in the back of the head with a beanbag, with a less lethal round. And so he tells them to keep down, and indicating his intent to do that. And so Rosenberg sees Coster move his right arm up and point his gun after he says he's going to fire a warning shot. And then this all happens very, very quickly. Threatens to fire the warning shot. Walter tells the others, "Stay down. I'm going to fire a less lethal round." The hand starts to come up. Rosenberg, the negotiator, ducks behind a SWAT safety ballistic shield. And two SWAT team members fire their weapons when they see this movement of the arm come up. Now, Walters says that he saw Coster point the gun. He said the gun was pointed right at their faces. He fired a beanbag round. But Gray, who had priority because he was up front, he had the best position to occupy, the best viewpoint to shoot, he said that he saw the arm come essentially to full extension, and it was pointed out towards them. So Walters fires the beanbag shot, but immediately after Walters fires the beanbag round, Gray fires three bullets at Coster's head, and two of them hit him. And emergency personnel transport him to a trauma center where he dies. And those are the facts, the relevant facts that we have to deal with here. So this goes to trial. You know what's going to happen. The attorney for the plaintiff here on behalf of Coster's estate, Don Sanzoni, brings a lawsuit, 1983 action, that federal cause of action under Title 42, that's often used to bring excessive use of force actions in federal court, civil actions in federal court, against officers Murphy and Gray and others, and asserted various claims, including false arrests and excessive force. So the discovery process takes place as it does in civil suit, and after discovery was completed, which is where the interrogatories are answered and the depositions occur, trying to answer questions, trying to get questions of fact on the record so that motions for summary judgment can be filed based on the discovery. The plaintiff's attorney argued that that the rights were violated. Of course, the defendant, law enforcement officers, state that they did not violate any clearly established constitutional right, which is essentially what they have to show for qualified immunity. At the trial level, things are getting a little tricky. Things are getting a little convoluted, you might say. Officer Murphy's given qualified immunity, but not Officer Gray. Remember, Officer Gray's the one that fired the lethal rounds. And the court said that questions of fact precluded summary judgment on the issue of qualified immunity. Remember, on a motion for summary judgment, and this is a legal thing, the lawyers know this, but not necessarily the LEOs, a motion for summary judgment in a civil action is where the plaintiff or the defendant will ask for the court to enter a judgment in favor of them because there is no material or genuine issue of fact to be resolved, and that under the facts, undisputed, as the undisputed facts are presented, that one side is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. So even if we go to trial, it doesn't matter. The facts are undisputed, and under these facts as undisputed, as a matter of law, one side or the other claims to be entitled to a judgment. And the plaintiff is trying to get this to trial. They want to go in front of a jury, and they're saying there are issues of fact that exist here that are going to preclude this from happening. They argued that the warning shot was not a threat, that there was no threat in the warning shot. He specifically said, "I'm going to fire a warning shot," and then he went to move his hand, and that was not a threat or did not present a deadly threat. And they also presented expert testimony where they have experts come in, and they said this expert testified that the degree of force used was unreasonable. It'd be really nice to dig into the weeds a little bit more and see what the basis of that opinion testimony was. In the end, the district court judge denied the qualified immunity. And the court, district court judge denied qualified immunity for two reasons specifically. First, he said Gray did not take cover. Remember, there were the ballistic shields that were right there. Rosenberg had already ducked behind one. That he did not take cover, and he did not wait for the less lethal option before shooting. He fired his rounds, three rounds at the head, almost immediately after Walters fired the beanbag round. And he did not wait to see what the impact of firing the beanbag round would be before he shot. And because of these two facts as presented, under a generalized standard, and he ruled that Gray used greater force than was reasonable because he did not take cover or wait for the less lethal option, and he only cited the general standard in Graham. He said it was unreasonable without alluding to any of the four specific Graham factors, and so qualified immunity was denied for Officer Gray, who's the one who fired the lethal shots. So that's the issue we have up on appeal, and that's what the Seventh Circuit's going to have to decide here. Is Officer Gray entitled to qualified immunity? In other words, did the district court judge make a mistake in issuing the ruling? Before I get to what the Seventh Circuit did, let's take a look at a few of the legal blasts from the past, and just briefly, but it's always good to go over these. Tennessee versus Garner, with that 1985 decision, you might recall, where the officer fired at the 15-year-old, the teenager, to keep him from getting away, to simply keep him from getting away. I went into a lot more depth than that a couple weeks ago in the special use of force edition that we had, and so I won't spend too much time. I invite you to go back and check that out a little bit more if you want to get down into the the nitty-gritty a little bit more with Tennessee versus Garner. But Tennessee versus Garner established a good example and a rule of law of when it would be reasonable to use deadly force. So applying that Fourth Amendment standard that came out 4 years later for all use of force decisions. You might want to say it became official in Graham versus Connor in 1989. Remember Graham, although the district court judge apparently didn't go through the factors and just made a general declaration that the degree of force was unreasonable. The Graham factors, and the notion is somewhat vague. I mean, to be told to tell an LEO with a firearm, hey, look, you can use any degree of force you want to use as long as it's reasonable. Well, what the heck does that mean? They understand that it's kind of a vague concept. And so they gave us these four Graham factors: the severity of the crime, the immediacy of the threat, active resistance, and attempting flight. You know, Jim McAdams, a good friend and a former colleague, gave me a great little mnemonic for that to remember those four Graham factors. SCITARAF, SCITARAF. Severity of the crime, immediacy of the threat, active resistance, and attempting flight. And I never forgot that. Being fond of going to New Orleans and eating some food, very jazzy place, it kind of reminded me of a jazz thing. SCITARAF, jazz hands, kind of sounds like something that you would put, Zatarain's would make to put in your Creole or your gumbo. But it makes it easier to remember. But you got to go through these four factors. Now, the factor that is most important in deadly force situations is the immediacy of the threat. And that's also the factor that's most vague. You know, they gave us these four factors to overcome the vague notion of what it took to be reasonable, but one of the four factors itself is vague, which is why the lower courts have endeavored to give us more additional secondary factors to help us determine how immediate the threat is. Well, when it comes to a firearm that's pointed at someone, the courts are pretty consistent in saying that once someone aims a firearm at someone, at a person, that there is an immediate threat at that point. So that's going to be the most important one. And then Saussure versus Katz, among other decisions, there have been others that have taken place, the qualified immunity decisions the Supreme Court has issued since then, a number of them. But this is a good case to establish the concept of qualified immunity. There's two questions in order to determine whether or not an officer will get qualified immunity. They will get qualified immunity unless the conduct violated a Fourth Amendment right and the right that was violated was clearly established at the time it was violated. So you have to have both. There has to be a Fourth Amendment violation, and it has to be that it was clearly established that it was a violation as of that time. There's a Ninth Circuit case that came out just today, and I was reading it just an hour ago. I'm probably going to talk about it in a blog post or another future webinar, where the Ninth Circuit just recently said that pointing a firearm at someone is use of force, just the pointing of it. But because it wasn't clearly established until that case, they gave the officer who pointed a firearm at someone qualified immunity. But that's a good example of where it takes both. It has to be a violation and it has to be clearly established. They don't have to answer these questions in any specific order. They can answer the second question first. You might recall in the Supreme Court decision, the Mullinex versus Luna decision, they jumped straight to the second question. And a lot of the circuits do that as well. And the Supreme Court has said these don't have to be answered in any particular order. And so sometimes they skip to the second question and say, you know what? Even if we assume, for argument's sake, that it was a Fourth Amendment violation without actually saying that it was, even if we assume that it was, it's not clearly established, and so we're going to give them qualified immunity. And that leaves the first question totally unanswered for future cases, which means qualified immunity will happen again in similar circumstances because it hasn't been clearly established that it's a violation. But that's the important concept for qualified immunity. That's what the court is going to have to look at here. So let's take a look at what happened. And there might be some facts in here, some factors that are weighing on you. Maybe the thought that one of the SWAT members was specifically stated prior to any of the shots being fired, I am going to fire a beanbag at this guy. I mean, one of the officers in front of him, and specifically Officer Gray, to duck to make sure they stayed low while he stayed high so he would fire the beanbag round. And the fact that there were the shields there and the fact that he said that he's just going to fire a warning shot, that he was indicating he wasn't going to shoot at anyone, but that he was going to fire the weapon as a warning. So what do you think? Well, here you go. They answered the first question first. Remember in Saussure, those two different questions, was there a Fourth Amendment violation? And if so, was it clearly established? Well, they answered that first question first in this particular case. And they said that applying the four Graham factors, specifically the factors and not a general notion of reasonableness, looking at the factors, the degree of force used was reasonable. He fully extended his arm, his right arm, with the firearm in his hand towards the officers in a firing position. So the muzzle's pointed at them. His arm is in a fully extended position towards the officers. And they don't have to trust his aim or his declaration that he's going to fire a warning shot. He could change his mind as he's going to fire a warning shot and actually shoot at him. They don't have to trust him and take him at his word that he's only going to fire a warning shot. And they don't have to trust his aim, even if he is. I mean, the gun is pointed towards them and his arm's fully extended. Even if he's going to fire a round off over them up into the wall or into the ceiling, at the point that the arm's fully extended and pointed in their direction, they don't have to trust his aim. And they also said that Officer Gray did not impermissibly escalate the situation by not taking cover. No, he didn't have to take cover. That's not required for the reasonableness standard under Graham. And so the fact that he did not take cover did not escalate the situation, make the situation more dangerous simply because he wasn't behind one of the SWAT ballistic shields. And so by his failure to get behind the shield didn't escalate to where the deadly force, it made the threat more deadly. And Graham doesn't require the use of a less deadly method before shooting. There's no under Graham, the use of deadly force is either reasonable or it's not under the facts that are presented at the time that deadly force is used. So it doesn't matter whether or not there's some less deadly or less lethal type of action that could have been taken. If deadly force is reasonable, then it's reasonable. And it won't be unreasonable to take less deadly force actions. But there's no spectrum, and they're not required to go through precursor steps. The determination's made at the moment in time that the deadly force is used. Was it reasonable under these four Graham factors? And with deadly force, that's always going to hinge on the immediacy of the threat, as the court addressed specifically in the facts in this case. Since they answered the first question first, the second question became moot. They answered the first question in favor of the defendant. They said that the qualified or that there was no Fourth Amendment violation. So they don't even get to whether or not it was clearly established because they're saying there wasn't one. The second question becomes a moot point at that point in time. So they said, hey, look, this is not unreasonable, that the use of force that was used is reasonable, and therefore Officer Gray is entitled to qualified immunity. Under these undisputed facts, as a matter of law, his actions were reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, and therefore he's entitled to a judgment, the motion for summary judgment in his favor. On this civil suit, and they reversed it and ordered that to take place. So there you go. And the great little review of the use of force, a short opinion. I think it's only about 7 or 8 pages long, not that long, and a good read, and I recommend it to you. Again, Seventh Circuit decision that came out. I always like to add a little footnote. I always like to leave you with something to think about before I sign off. And this case, there's a quote from this case I want to briefly mention to you and have you think about this a little. Whether a reasonable officer, the Seventh Circuit said the test is whether a reasonable officer in the circumstances would have probable cause to believe that the suspect poses an immediate threat to the safety of the officers or others. And they're focusing in on that second of the four Graham factors, the immediacy of the threat, which I've indicated is the primary factor when you're talking about deadly force situations. And that's the standard, whether a reasonable officer in the circumstances would have probable cause to believe they posed immediate threat. Now, the reason I'm pointing this out for discussion is because I had I did a podcast and a webinar a week or two ago about the reasonable officer standard. And this is getting back to that concept of, are they the facts that are actually known to the officer at the point force is used, or are they the facts that were presented to a reasonable officer? In other words, do you have to show what the officer was actually, what facts that officer who used the force was actually aware of? And it might seem like it's an academic discussion, but it really cuts to the heart of a lot of issues that are taking place right now, and not the least of which is the body cam, use of body cam video in order to prepare use of force reports. Because some people take the position that the rule is, what are the facts known to the officer at the time force is used? And if that's truly the case, if that is the standard, you need to understand that it's not a purely objective standard anymore. It's a subjective objective standard, because the first question you're going to have to ask is asking the officer, what facts were you aware of when you did this? The other side of that, and what other folks tend to say, is that it's the facts that are presented at the time. And you're using this objective reasonable officer standard. And so you need to look at all of the facts that were available that are there and presented not to that one specific officer, but at the time force was used. So that would a reasonable officer think that the degree of force used was reasonable based on all of the facts that are there at the time that the force is used? So that becomes an interesting debate on which of those two standards apply. To be free and clear and make sure you understand the bias issues, I've kind of leaned towards the second one. I don't think it's a subjective / objective standard. And there are cases to where the courts considered facts without attributing those facts specifically to the officer who use the deadly force, which tends to indicate that it is a purely objective standard based on the facts that were that are known to the reasonable officer at the time force is used, and not necessarily to that one specific officer. But it's an interesting debate, and one will currently that will have more a lot of current cases involved in this type of interesting situation, a dichotomy between these two different opposing points of view with respect to the reasonable officer standard. We'll have to see where that falls out, and only time will tell. Thank you so much for joining me this week. Time flies when you're having fun. Keep it to a half hour, which is most of you have requested, and I'm fulfilling that request. I want to thank you for joining me today at Broadcast Blue on this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. Don't forget about the podcast. Please check www.broadcastblue. As I often say, our name is our website address. Information about upcoming webinars and podcasts and how to stream these things. I want to invite you to next week. I'll be coming to you live from St. Louis, Missouri. I'll be at the ILETA conference in the International Law Enforcement Educator and Trainers Association, ILETA, there in St. Louis, the conference. I'm presenting next week on the issue of the use of body cam or video in order to prepare police reports. Going to do an interesting 2-hour presentation on that. And so if you're going to be in the St. Louis area, you want to come to ILETA, maybe I'll see some of you there. Please make an effort to step up and introduce yourself and let me say hi to you face-to-face. I also want to let you know that there are a lot more cases that come out than what I produce podcasts for, and so I'm going to start producing very short blog posts on the Broadcast Blue website. It's going to be called Blog Blue, and I'm going to blog these cases, and it's a very short, maybe a page, a summary of what's going on, and a link so you can download the case and read it yourself as they pop up. So you can check that every day. and see what new cases have popped up. Follow the blog. Please tell others about Broadcast Blue, the podcast. It's important that I get the number of subscriptions up. And so if you could share the information about the Broadcast Blue channel with others at www.broadcast.blue. And there's links, all kinds of links to sign up for the podcast and the webinars. I want to also remind you of the Brown Bag Vimeo channel, Broadcast Blue Vimeo channel for these Brown Bag videos, where I make these videos available. If you're not one of the few people that can join me live, you can watch, not just listen to the podcast, but actually watch a video recording of the podcast on our Vimeo channel. You can find out more information about that on broadcast.blue. You can also go straight to the Vimeo channel itself at brownbag.video. That's actually the URL. One little thing I want to point out, for those of you who joined me for Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinars for 2 years, before I retired from the Department of Homeland Security, a lot of those videos are available on the video channel for the first time. They're available on the Vimeo channel as well. The Brown Bag Classics are available on the Vimeo channel for you to watch. And one last little nugget, just a little bit teaser. I want you to keep your eye open on www.leo.law. Leo.law. That's coming this summer, and we're going to pull a lot of these things together with training opportunities with Leah and Broadcast Blue and the Brown Bag webinars. Going to pull it all together, and so that's an exciting thing that's on the horizon that I want to make you aware of. Well, time's up for this episode. Thank you so much for joining me, and thank you so much for what you do, and I hope to see you again next week.